Nuclear responsibility. From the first atomic bomb blast in New Mexico in 1945, American citizens have been harmed by exposure to radiation from 100 above-ground test blasts and fallout, manufacture of nuclear weapons, refinement of uranium ore for those weapons, badly disposed of radioactive waste, and the general debris caused by all things nuclear. The only recourse for those harmed by exposure to U.S.-generated radioactive materials here in the United States has been the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, which has been in place since 1990. Now, RECA is up for extension and expansion in Senate Bill 3853, which received bipartisan passage in the Senate. President Biden has announced that he will sign the bill, and it is believed to have enough votes in the House to pass. But Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has refused repeatedly to bring it to a vote on the floor of the House. And if it is not passed by the House by June 7, the entire program will expire. So what is preventing Speaker Johnson from bringing it to a vote? It takes a downwinder and an activist to put it all in focus. And she tells you,
well, I guess it would be to the hardliners in the Republican Party who are saying we can't afford to do anything. But again, they can afford to do over $12 trillion since the Manhattan Project they spent on nuclear weapons. They are slated to spend $1.5 trillion more over the next 30 years. So there's plenty of money to make war. There's plenty of money for nuclear weapons. But there's not the money, they say, to take care of the people they've harmed.
Well, when author, activist, and downwinder Mary Dixon points out how absurd are the claims that this country has no funds to compensate U.S. citizens who have been directly harmed by our nuclear weapons program, you see yet another ugly aspect of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, as the continued existence of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, comes down to the wire, we talk with Mary Dixon. She is a downwinder, author, playwright, and activist who has been deeply involved in getting RECA extended and expanded. She gives us an update on where things stand now, less than 2 weeks from the deadline to pass Senate Bill 3853 in the House, or the program ends. She fills us in on the most recent fast one that was attempted to undercut the passage of this bill. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, the ICAN update, news from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, direct from the ICAN headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, and more honest nuclear information than was mentioned in any Memorial Day commemorative events. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 28, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. A new report finds that sites with radioactive material have become more vulnerable as climate change increases, wildfires, flood, and violent weather, such as tornadoes. Among the sites threatened are research laboratories, weapons sites, and power plants across the country that handle or are contaminated with radioactive material or perform critical energy and defense research. We'll have a link up to that article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 675. The owner of the controversial uranium mine near the Grand Canyon intends to send about 6 trucks of uranium ore a day, roughly 300 miles, through cities and towns in Arizona, Navajo Nation, and Utah, to the company's White Mesa uranium mill for processing. The highways the haul trucks will travel are mostly 2 lanes, 1 lane in each direction, winding and unlit, and communities along the haul route are not happy. The plan has been steadfastly opposed by the group Haul No, and pushback against this plan by the Pinyon Plain Mine, formerly the Canyon Mine, is growing in cities and counties through which the ore is supposed to be transported, including the city of Flagstaff, Arizona, Cameron, Tuba City, and Kayenta on Navajo Nation, and Bluff, Utah. In 1987, 2 separate accidents involving haul trucks resulted in uranium ore spilling across highways on Navajo Nation. In 1997, a uranium haul truck jackknifed in Colorado Springs, spreading ore across Interstate 25 and closing the highway. More recently, in 2015 and 2016, trucks hauling waste from in-situ leaching uranium mines in Wyoming to the White Mesa Mill have leaked radioactive sludge along Utah's highways. Lots of opposition, no word as to whether anyone in genuine power in this situation has even paid attention. Speaking of waste, a research expedition led by UC Santa Barbara came across old discarded barrels of radioactive waste sitting 3,000 feet underwater near Santa Catalina Island. We'll have a link up to that article. The Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter has returned, and this week she talks about how the Lyndon LaRouche crowd cravenly promoted building a nuclear power plant in Gaza at a Free Palestine rally. No one bought it.
Last week, wearing my occasional reporter's hat for the UK daily newspaper, The Morning Star, I ventured down to Washington's National Mall in the rain, hoping to get a new angle from protesters at one more rally for a Gaza ceasefire and free Palestine. Whatever one's views on the conflict there, how it began and how it should be resolved, the one indisputable fact is that the Palestinian population are experiencing a grave humanitarian crisis and that Gaza, as a livable region, is being systematically destroyed. Whatever the outcome, it will take a very long time to restore both structures and infrastructure to the Gaza Strip and provide services for any populations hoping to live there. Therefore, it was with particular disgust that I observed a banner at the rally proclaiming that what was needed most right now was to, quote, build LaRouche's Oasis Plan. LaRouche refers to Lyndon LaRouche, and the plan is the construction of a nuclear power plant in Gaza to power seawater desalination. The fact that Lyndon LaRouche, described by Politico as a proto-fascist, is dead was never mentioned in the handouts about his terrific plan. The flyers and fact sheets were being distributed by decidedly ancient followers who came across as harmless, if earnest, elders. All of this masked the truly scary agenda that the LaRouches, as they are known, advance. But the younger man holding the banner, who was wearing full camo, was probably a bit of a clue. So is the time LaRouche spent in prison for fraud, because pushing new nuclear to anyone, let alone a population under siege who are running for their lives, is a fraud of the highest order. The LaRouche crowd has bird-dogged the anti-nuclear movement for years, but even so, it was appalling to see them preying on the passion and desperation of the Palestinians and their supporters at this rally. How to handle this, I asked myself as my blood began to boil. The first thing was to remove my press credential and put my Beyond Nuclear hat back on, not something I had expected to need, metaphorical or otherwise, on this particular occasion. And the next step was to reverse the bird-dog strategy. After the eager octogenarian had engaged members of the crowd with his red herring question, what's more important, oil or water, and handed out his literature, I got him behind him to set the record straight. What was most encouraging was that no one had bought the Nukes for Gaza plan. They didn't even know that LaRouche was the king of conspiracy theories long before they were fashionable. They just knew that trying to build a nuclear power plant in Gaza, even without a war, was handing yet more atomic opportunities to Israel, already a nuclear weapon state, and with or without a war, was the least practical solution to providing clean water or anything else. The Palestinians, the LaRouche agent approach, were actually appalled at this vulture-like opportunism and outraged that their grief and pain would be used in this way in the first place, let alone to promote a technology that would lead them into a new catastrophe. "Would Israel even allow it?" asked one of the leafleter's recipients. "Well, the war would have to end first," was the reply. Well, duh, that was, after all, why the crowd was here, to get an immediate ceasefire, not to set themselves up as permanent custodians of an endless stream of long-lived radioactive waste. The rain got steadily heavier, and the LaRouche elders abandoned ship. That's what they should do with their ridiculous Oasis plan. Throw it overboard. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's Hot Story.
Internationally, Russian forces have started military drills near Ukraine, simulating the use of tactical nuclear weapons in response to what Moscow deems threats from Western officials about increased involvement in the conflict. The Russian Defense Ministry published footage on Tuesday showing trucks carrying missiles to a field where launch systems had been prepared and troops at an airfield readying a bomber to carry a nuclear warhead. And Vladimir Solovyov, a Russian propagandist and ally to President Vladimir Putin, insisted, quote, "nuclear war is inevitable." He did this on a recent episode of his television show. He continued, "We should just accept it. The only promise life keeps is that of death. A man wins when he stops fearing death." For an oppositional consideration of this, here's the monthly ICAN update. A report from the Nobel Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons on international activism and progress on the United Nations Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons. It comes to us directly from ICANN headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, with their head of media, Alistair Burnett.
Hi, I'm Alistair Burnett at ICANN in Geneva, and here's our roundup of news from the campaign for May. The past month saw our executive director, Melissa Park, travel to the Vatican for the World Meeting on Human Fraternity, which is convened by the Fratelli Tutti Foundation. ICAM was invited along with other winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. The aim of the get-together is to discuss ways to tackle humanity's most pressing problems, and ICAM made sure that nuclear weapons was high on the agenda and that the UN Nuclear Ban Treaty, the TPNW, is seen as the solution to ending this existential threat. Melissa also met the Pope, who reiterated his opposition to nuclear weapons by condemning their possession and use as immoral. We're also in the process of updating and producing new resources on our website for people interested in nuclear weapons and the threat they pose to us all. The idea is to make sure that when people search the internet for answers to their questions and concerns, we can ensure ICAN is one of the first places that come up offering answers to their questions. Check out our website at www.icanw.org. This time last year, you may remember the leaders of the G7 industrialized countries met in Hiroshima for their annual summit. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, whose family is from Hiroshima, hosted the summit there as he said he wanted to give a boost to nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament. ICAN was there as part of the civil society involvement in the summit. We co-hosted a youth summit ahead of the meeting. We also organised a delegation of parliamentarians from G7 countries who support the TPNW to go to Hiroshima. We gave lots of media interviews while we were there to encourage journalists to hold the leaders to account for their lack of progress on disarmament so far. ICAN's deputy director, Daniel Hoogster, who was acting executive director at the time, was there. So 1 year on, I asked him to give me his assessment of what the meeting achieved.
On actually making progress towards nuclear disarmament or making the world safer from the risk of nuclear weapons, and they've done nothing. They haven't backed up their grand words with anything that resembles action, and that has to be considered a failure of leadership.
Mr. Kishida, whose family is from Hiroshima, says nuclear disarmament is a priority for him personally, but he talks about the way to achieving that is through the non-proliferation treaty and not the TPNW. That should be the end point in his view. Do you think that strategy has any prospect of success?
Well, I think I still think that the decision to hold the G7 in Hiroshima was a commendable one from Mr. Kishida. Unfortunately, that kind of idea of pushing the TPNW to way to the future after all the problems of nuclear weapons have been solved is very much the wrong way of looking at it, and it really doesn't have any chance of success. The TPNW comes out of the NPT. It comes out of Article 6 of the NPT, which obligates states to negotiate new measures towards nuclear disarmament. So really, it's the beginning of the commitment of many of these states towards actually achieving concrete progress.
So ultimately, what do you think is stopping the G7 states from actually taking the lead on disarmament, as they appeared to suggest they would do in their declaration at the end of the meeting last year?
Well, I mean, it's important to remember that the G7 states are all complicit in nuclear weapons. You've got three nuclear weapon states in the G7, and you've got four countries that endorse nuclear weapons in their national security doctrine. So you could say that's what's stopping them is their own policies. But of course, also they also endorse the theory and the practice of nuclear deterrence, which itself is an extremely dangerous doctrine. So really, it's a lack of leadership on their part. It's a bit of hypocrisy and a complete absence of political courage.
That was Daniel Hoekstra, ICANN's deputy director. Before I sign off, just to mention that the week of action on nuclear weapons spending I mentioned last month will now be taking place in September in the run-up to the Summit of the Future at the UN in New York. This summit will look to regenerate progress on building a fairer and more sustainable world and reinvigorate the Sustainable Development Goals, many of which were thrown into reverse by the COVID-19 pandemic. The new date for the Week of Action is the 16th to 22nd of September. Keep an eye on our website for information on how to get involved.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, what bothers you the most about nuclear? Bombs, forever quantities of highly radioactive waste, cancer threats, contamination of land that many of us live near, if not on. You can do nothing about nuclear threats to health and safety without knowing the truth, what it is and what it does. And communicating that truth is the mandate of Nuclear Hot Seat. We provide you with information you need to understand what's happening in the nuclear industry from a source that is not influenced by the millions upon millions of dollars they spend in their never-ending weekly propaganda machine. We cover what you face in terms of threats to health, welfare, and safety, and what you, what we, what any of us can do about it. Every week, we bring you the kind of nuclear information that mainstream media just doesn't seem to have the heart or time or money to put on the air or in print. We provide verifiable nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you about people on the front lines of activism around the world, their triumphs, challenges, and how you can help. Here's one way you can help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations, and we cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation or monthly recurring, you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means your donation is tax-deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or you can send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large, so go knock yourself out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate, and know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. We are fast approaching the deadline for passage of the bill to expand and extend the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. This program was created to compensate those, or rather I should say some of those, harmed by exposure to radioactive materials from U.S. production of nuclear weapons, downwind fallout from above-ground testing, and exposure to long-lived World War II radioactive weapons waste. I say some of those harmed, because the original program was severely limited as to the downwind states and counties covered, the people eligible for compensation, the kinds of illnesses that qualified for compensation, and even the amount provided, $50,000, which is nothing when one faces medical bills from dealing with radiation-caused cancer, autoimmune diseases, and other illnesses. A battle has been raging on Capitol Hill to get Senate Bill 3853, the extension and expansion of RECA, passed into law, and time is running short. It passed the Senate, but it's being hung up in the House because Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has not yet allowed this bill to go to the House floor for a vote. Here to tell us the latest on RECA and how short the time is until the program expires is Mary Dixon. She is a Salt Lake City journalist and writer, and a downwinder. She has been recognized by the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility for her lifetime work on behalf of downwinders and regularly speaks out against the resumption of nuclear testing as well as her downwinder information talks. She's been deeply involved in the current drive to pass this extension and expansion of RECA, and here brings us up to date on where we stand, what we're up against, and how little time is left. I spoke with Mary Dixon on Sunday, May 26, 2024. Mary Dixon, thanks so much for joining us on short notice here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Always a pleasure. I love talking with you.
We love talking with you, too, and especially now that we're coming down to the wire with the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. Give people who may not be familiar with it a brief rundown of what's been happening and bring it up to date as of the most recent lobbying trip.
Sure. Okay, so as you know, we've been trying to get legislation introduced by Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, Senator Ben Ray Lujan of Santa Fe, and Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho. They're a bipartisan group. Lujan's the only Democrat there. We've been trying to get that onto the floor of the House for a vote. So it expands RECA, includes a lot more people than the very limited original act. And it's passed easily, this bill, in the Senate. Strong bipartisan support, which was very surprising. The vote was 69 to 30. So we had more votes than we needed. So now it must go through the House. And as you know, the House has been, well, to put, say, in disarray is putting it mildly. They've been fairly dysfunctional. So it's been very hard to get something introduced there. I mean, the bill's ready to go. It just has to come up for a vote, which is up to Speaker Johnson. I mean, he has said to Representative Wagner of Missouri, a fellow Republican, that he wants to move ahead on RECA, but hasn't been specific about that at all. So we're waiting. So in the meantime, last week, this was Thursday, we had been in D.C. to do a prayer vigil, to meet with different congressional offices, and then a press conference. I spoke at that. We got a coverage in the New York Times. There was a wonderful opinion piece that ran. So we're seeing strong support, strong editorials all around the country saying, it's time to do this. We've got to do this. Just on Friday, Senator Mike Lee, one of my senators, who's not been helpful in all of this at all, because both Mike Lee and Mitt Romney voted against that bill in the Senate.
They are both senators in Utah, and Utah is one of the states that RECA would be expanded to cover. What has been their reasoning for not backing it?
Well, two things they've said. One, it's too broad. It adds too many other areas. And the other is, oh, it costs too much, which to me is very specious because they both are in favor of the Sentinel missile that's already at $130 billion, going up to $160 billion, and is expected to have many more cost overruns. They support that. They do not, however, support taking care of the people nuclear weapons have harmed, their own constituents, because only half of Utah right now is covered. So they're just saying, no, we can't add all these other areas, which are states in the West, surrounding Utah, New Mexico, where Trinity was detonated, has never been covered. So it would add downwinders from Trinity as well as from all the nuclear testing in Nevada. It would add Guam, where the U.S. tested in the Pacific, people are still suffering. It would add more categories of uranium miners who they were sent into those mines without protective gear. Those mines have not been remediated. People are still finding there's uranium in their water. There's uranium in their soil. They have found uranium in the children's blood. People there are getting sick and they're dying. Their situation is incredibly sad because they don't even have access to medical care. So it would have added them. It would have added areas around St. Louis, Missouri, where nuclear waste from the Manhattan Project all those years ago is stored. It would also add Paducah, Kentucky, which is where also nuclear weapons were produced, and there is waste there. It would add areas in Tennessee, same story, where Manhattan Project weapons were being built, and there is waste there. It would add areas of Amchitka, Alaska, also. So it adds these isolated areas. But our senators are saying, oh no, that's too much. Mike Lee, so what he did, this was a fast one, just on this last week, Mike Lee goes to the floor of the Senate, introduces a bill that would merely expand RECA another 2 years. Well, he had 2 years ago introduced a bill that extended RECA only for 2 years, as it was. Now he's coming back saying, well, let's just extend it 2 years again. So they just keep kicking this can down the road as people are dying. Josh Hawley took to the floor and said, I won't support this. No, it's not enough. And your Senator Romney said that the people who were determined to have suffered have already been taken care of, which is not true, just not true, because not even their whole state has been taken care of. The people I mentioned in all these other places have not been taken care of. I mean, Josh Hawley just said, we won't support this bill. And it was introduced as unanimous consent, meaning everyone had to agree to it. So Mike Lee had to know it would not pass.
For clarification, when you say unanimous consent, is that like a recorded vote? Is that a voice vote? Is that they're raising their hands?
Unanimous consent is a fast track way to bring a bill to the floor, but you have to have everyone voting for it. Well, right away, both Senator Hawley, Senator Lujan spoke passionately, staunchly opposing just an extension, saying we've extended it. It is time to expand it and include all those who've been excluded. So he knew right away it wasn't going to pass. Then this is what gets interesting. So Mike Lee comes back and he says, I would like to amend my bill. I would like to add Utah, New Mexico, and Missouri, because we have evidence those people were harmed. And once again, both Hawley and Lujan made very impassioned remarks saying, no, those were not the only people harmed. That is not far enough. Why are you introducing this when we've already passed a bill in the Senate to include this broader area? You know, we've already decided this in the Senate, and not just in the standalone bill in March, but remember when it was part of the NDAA and the Senate had passed it as part of the NDAA.
NDAA?
As part of the National Defense Authorization Act. It had passed in the Senate twice. So for Senator Lee to now come in last minute and say, I'm going to do this grand thing, I'm going to extend it 2 years. Oh, wait, now I'm going to add Utah, New Mexico, and Missouri, but no one else because there's not evidence for them. When there has been evidence for all these areas and is evidence for all these areas that these people have suffered and that they were indeed harmed. So it didn't pass. I don't think he thought it would pass. So now the pressure is on Mike Johnson to bring it to the floor of the House for a vote. Representative Teresa Ledger Fernandez, who is in New Mexico and has introduced the bill in the House, along with James Moylan of Guam. In her speech at the press conference, she said, "We have enough votes. It would pass if you brought it to the floor." Representative Cori Bush from Missouri got up and she said, "Speaker Johnson, you wanted this job. Now do your job." Very, very firm. And we're hoping that he's hearing from a lot of people. There are many editorials around the country, including in the Times, it was in the Sunday Times, again, just today, are saying, do the right thing. Expand RECA. This needs to be done. And as you said at the beginning, we are down to the wire.
How many days of Congress actually being in session do we have before RECA expires? And I believe the expiration date is June 7, 2024.
Yes. So we have 5 days when they get back because they're again in recess for Memorial Day. So we have, once they're back, just 5 days for this to happen. Just five. So I think right now people are looking at every possible way they can reach Johnson, because we've already had President Biden make a statement saying, I will sign this into law the minute it passes.
So in other words, everything is in place except Mike Johnson. So
yes,
let's speculate for a moment. What in the world is keeping him from doing this? Has he been bought off? Is he being blackmailed? Does he have some kind of a bonus coming to him if he makes certain that these people are denied the finances?
You know what? I don't know. I don't know why he isn't. I think they just haven't been very good about passing legislation in the House. And they get distracted with all these petty things, like, you know, he did have time to go up to New York outside the courtroom for Trump's trial to show his support, but he didn't have time to legislate, which is what, as Cori Bush said, do your job. And he is hearing from a lot of people. So I don't know why he would be against it. It's a political win for him. It would be a win for him.
So flipping this over, there's got to be a reason. It can't just be that, you know, he's had some kind of like a brain aneurysm. Or he doesn't have time for it. It's got to be blatantly clear to him at this point that this is something that he needs to do, that the country is clamoring for him to do, and yet he is not doing it. So this is when I put on my devious hat and try and figure out, what's the money? Follow the money. Whose benefit is this to not pass RECA?
Well, I guess it would be to the hardliners in the Republican Party who are saying, we can't afford to do anything. But again, they can afford to do over $12 trillion since the Manhattan Project they spent on nuclear weapons. They are slated to spend $1.5 trillion more over the next 30 years. So there's plenty of money to make war. There's plenty of money for nuclear weapons, but there's not the money, they say, to take care of the people they've harmed.
I don't believe them. It's a matter of will and vision and intent and doing the right thing. It's about having a moral structure, an ethical structure, and actually following it to the point of conclusion, which is help these people who have been harmed by our own government.
Exactly. You hit it on the nail. It is a moral decision. It's a matter of priorities, and anything short of expanding it, to me, is a moral failure, and they will be on the wrong side of history.
I don't think there's a single politician anywhere who's ever gone, oh, gee, I can't do that. It would put me on the wrong side of history. We have to find things to threaten them with, like demonstrators. I mean, our side is always so polite. I am not advocating violence. I am not advocating anything terribly illegal. But I remember back in earlier days in the gay community when AIDS was growing and there was no response coming from government, and a group called ACT UP got started. They weren't violent, but they were very dramatic, very visible, very disruptive, and they got a lot of press and a lot of coverage and moved things forward, because if nothing else, the more moderate people would say, look, you know, we'd like to solve this by conversation, but if we don't have something to show our people, you're going to be up against ACT UP and we can't stop them. So we almost need to have that kind of a branch within our movement to bring attention to the fact that these people, Mike Johnson right now, if he allows this to lapse by not bringing it to the floor, he's guilty of murder, mass murder. And we have to have some way of bringing that home to him so that it's going to hurt if he does the wrong thing. I don't know what that action is. I don't know what it can be. Again, I do not advocate violence. I do advocate volume.
And you know what? The heat is definitely on right now. There was a group of women from Missouri, from the St. Louis area, who were impacted, whose families are sick, who are sick themselves. And they met with his staff, and the staff, they said, was surprised to learn of all this. You know, we hear that all the time. We didn't know how bad it was. You know, we'll tell him, we'll tell him. But, you know, you never know when you talk to staffers if they deliver the message with the same passion to the representatives. You just don't know. Because I've had staffers in various offices say, oh, I'm sure he'll support this. And I know he won't, you know? But people are always shocked when they learn all the stories. They had no idea how widespread fallout was. They had no idea all the toxic exposures from uranium mining that still exist, or from all the nuclear waste, the toxins that still exist.
I took a brief look. I skipped my way through the video you sent me of the press conference, which we will link to up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 675. There was a woman at about the half hour mark who said, World War II is still killing people in this country.
Yes.
And I hadn't heard it put like that before. And she is absolutely right. You are all, I know you've had your own health challenges and difficulties within your family as well because of exposure to the radiation in Utah. You were in Salt Lake City, right?
Right.
Which is not covered by RECA because, of course, there's a dotted line where the radiation looks at that and goes, oh, we can't go over this. We can't move any further. Yeah, right. I get so angry and so frustrated by this, but it's not understood, first of all, the Miller map, which we will post, which shows the pathway that radioactive materials took from the Nevada test site and from Trinity across the country into 46 states plus Canada and Mexico. There seems to be a blind spot or a brain fart or something that stops people from looking at this, having a denial system that prevents them from looking at this and going, wow, it really was that bad. It really hurt that many people. It's still hurting all of these people. We have to do something about it. It is the moral, ethical imperative. So given that so much has been done by phone calls, by email, by petitions, by even meeting face-to-face, and Dawn Chapman doesn't like me to use the L word, lobbying, because she's in a nonprofit and she's apparently not supposed to lobby, but putting a human face on the issue that's being discussed. With all of that that has already happened and has not yet come to critical mass with these people, what do you suggest we do over the next 2 weeks, even though they're not in session this week, but over the next 2 weeks to help support this and move it forward? I'll take a Hail Mary pass on it.
I would say people have to keep calling Representative Johnson's office. They have to call Representative Scalise, his office, because Johnson listens to him. They need to just keep hounding away and say, you've got to do this. You've got to do this. And I know a lot of people who were affected have been calling, telling their stories and saying, this is what happened. There was one of the women in Missouri who, when she called Scalise's staffers, said, your son has the same cancer my son did, but my son didn't survive. I mean, if that doesn't reach someone, I don't know what does.
When I do group presentations, when I do speeches, especially if it's a group that maybe is not particularly up on these issues, I like to ask, is there anybody in the audience, by a show of hands, how many people in this audience do not know in your personal life a single person, including yourself, who either has or had cancer? You don't know anyone, by a show of hands. 3, 2, 1. You know, I've never had a single hand go up. Yeah. Everyone knows someone with cancer, but they don't connect it to radiation, radioactivity, and the source of that radioactivity.
Exactly. You know, I was reading all the comments to the New York Times op-ed, and well, it was an opinion piece. I was reading them, and some people said, well, it happened a long time ago. Like, why do they want it now? And I thought, no, no, no. With the latency period of cancer, you can develop cancer after exposure anytime during your lifetime. So no, the latency period has not is there. It's real. And then they were saying, well, these people, they're grifters. They just want the money. It was so long ago. And it's like, do you think really that $50,000 or $100,000 covers what the cost we have already borne in medical bills, in sleepless nights, in losing our loved ones? Do you think that amount is anywhere near close to even what I would call restitution? It's not. Then you have scientists weighing in saying, don't people know this went across the country? There were some of those. There was a scientist in Wyoming who said, oh, they used to tell us how much strontium was in the water. So, you know, some people do know, but I still think that a lot of people don't understand what happened with the radiation. They don't understand what happened with the people who helped to produce and develop those weapons. They don't understand what happened to the people living around where the waste from those weapons was stored. And the thing that I think is really kind of the saddest is that they don't even think they themselves may have been affected.
I think you've nailed it there, because there's a saying in 12-step programs that denial is more than a river in Egypt. And it's terribly difficult to be raised and propagandized your entire life with how wonderful the bomb was, and it ended World War II, and it was very powerful, and it saved American lives. But what I've been doing a lot of research into this lately. What is eliminated from that conversation is radiation, radioactivity, the impact on health, the duration of it. If people understood what radiation was and is, where it comes from, how persistent it is, for how long it's persistent, and what it actually does, we would stop all nuclear activities immediately and put all of that money into figuring out ways to clean the stuff up.
Yes, yes. It's so true. It's so true. We would, because we don't take care of that. We just don't. And, you know, the woman who said, we're still living with World War II. I mean, we are casualties of the Cold War. We were harmed by that. We sacrificed a lot. We were sacrificed. And it's been a terrible price we've paid, a terrible price. And it's long past time for the government to do something, because literally, think about it. The people who would qualify are dying off. Because if you're a downwinder of the test site, you had to have lived in areas between 51 and 62. A lot of those people are gone already.
There's a saying that I've heard involved with RECA and other programs dealing with radiation exposure: delay, deny until they die.
Oh, that gave me a chill. Oh, delay, deny until they die.
I think I heard that first from Tina Cordova. They did this also with the sailors from the USS Reagan, who went to Fukushima in the immediate aftermath of the disaster to give aid, not knowing about the radiation that they were being exposed to and that was being deposited on the ship and that made so many of them ill. But yet that information is not made generally available. So only individual sailors find out if they happen to show up at the doctor's office at the same time and share notes with each other. Oh, I was on the Reagan. Oh, I was on the Reagan. There is a conspiracy of silence. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there is, it's fair to say, I believe, a conspiracy of silence about the impact of radioactivity, radiation on human beings in the wake of, I certainly know about nuclear reactors, but certainly in the wake of the bombs and the tests and the manufacture and all the rest of it. So we have been denied direct access as this issue rolled out as to what these bombs and their aftermath and their manufacture and the aftermath of that actually do to human beings, human life, DNA, the map of our genomic future as a human species is what is being assaulted by this, except we have not been given the opportunity to learn this in a timely manner. And now we are living with the consequences, and even knowing the consequences, we can't get the term that I can't say on the radio in Congress and elsewhere to take this seriously and do something about it, because it's not going to go away ever.
No, ever. Ever is right. You know, they actually had a study in Salt Lake City that was reported on in the last month. Researchers at the University of Utah looked at air quality indoors. Do you know what they found? Uranium.
Uranium?
Uranium. And they said it had to be from the testing because the kind it was. And so for people to think this didn't really happen or it went away or no, we are still living with it. Uranium has what, a half-life as long as the Earth? It never goes away, never.
And plutonium, which is, of course, in the waste stream of all reactors, as well as being the basic material for building bombs, that merely has a half-life of 25,000 years, which means it's a quarter of a million years before that thing becomes less deadly than it is, but then it turns into a form of uranium that has an additional half-life of like a million years. My numbers in specificity as they get larger may be off, but the reality of the horror that has been unleashed upon this planet has not.
We are still living with it. It hasn't gone away. And saying about the denial, the outright lies, the cover-ups, that's always been the way these issues have been handled, not just in America, everywhere, not just for nuclear weapons, but as you say, also for nuclear power, that the denial is so huge that it's such a major, major, I cannot say just how utterly immoral it is, what's been done, how utterly immoral that you know what something does and you still do it. And people suffer, and you see it, and you know it. I mean, you just need to look at minutes like from the Atomic Energy Commission. All along the way, they said, we need the judicious handling of public information, which is a lovely way of saying propaganda and lies.
I have a story coming up on the Atomic Museum in Las Vegas. Have you ever been?
Yes, I went there. I was so outraged. I went there and took notes like crazy on every exhibit. And I had a guard come up to me and say, is your name Mary Dixon? I said, yeah, how'd you know that? Oh, they said you were coming. You have to come see the most important thing. And he took me to the very end of the exhibit where there was a plaque by a case, a part of the Trade Center from September 11th. And he said, you need to read this. It's the most important thing in here. And there was a plaque that said, because of the war on terror, the Nevada test site stands ready to resume testing again. And I thought, oh my God, we never learn. We never learn.
So for those of us who wish to learn, what you're saying is get on auto dial to Mike Johnson's office and pester the bejesus out of the guy.
Yes.
And who was the other one you said?
A Representative Scalise, also from Louisiana. And tell them they must do everything in their power to get S-3853 to the House floor for a vote, and they better do it fast.
Because if not, we're forming our own ACT UP group, and they are number one and number two on our hit list. Not hit as in violence, not hit as in mafia style hit, but in terms of we will harass you till your dying day if you don't do this.
Yeah. They need to hear from a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, Mary, are you going to be going back there at all for that final week?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I was there the week before last and it was exhausting. And one of the most depressing things was meeting with people from my own delegation from Utah.
And that was because?
Turned their back on us. Some of them are saying, well, we'll go for an extension. It's like, no, that's not adequate. It's time to finally do the right thing. You can't keep putting it off.
Well, we will do everything on our part here to support it, to get the information out, to do auto dial to Mike Johnson's office. And we'll stay in touch on this. And hopefully by June 7, we will have something to celebrate. Yeah. As opposed to something that will enrage us, infuriate us, and lead to other actions.
Yeah, and just break our hearts, break our hearts.
Well, I've got some super glue. We can glue them back together again with each other. And
yes.
And hopefully that's not going to be the case, but the right thing is going to be done.
I hope so. I hope so. I think this is the most momentum we've ever had. It's our best chance.
Mary Dixon, you've been fighting this fight for so long and doing it so well. Deep appreciation and love to you for everything that you have done, and most specifically for once again being one of my favorite people to bring on to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much. You're making me cry. Thank you so much. A pleasure. And what you do is so important. Thank you. Thank you for what you do. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you.
That was Mary Dixon, author, activist, downwinder. Your help is needed to help build pressure on Mike Johnson and get him to bring Rika to a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives. So here's what you can do. Call Mike Johnson's office at 202-225-2777. It will go, of course, immediately to voicemail, but hopefully, even if they don't listen, they will count your numbers. And we need to keep this up, so feel free to call every day, multiple times a day. Let's keep hammering him. Also in our sights is House Majority Leader Stephen Joseph Scalise. He apparently has some sway or influence over what Mike Johnson actually does. You can call Representative Scalise at 202-225-3015. Please, don't hold back and don't delay. As I noted in the interview, there was a slogan around RECA and other government programs dealing with health, which is delay, deny, until they die. Don't let that happen here. Please lend your voice to this push. And we will, of course, have the phone numbers available on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 675.
Activists, activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
Heads up on a terrific new film that any of us can see for free. It's called The Vow from Hiroshima, and it is the biopic of human rights campaigner, Nobel Peace Laureate, and Hiroshima A-bomb survivor, Setsko Thurlow. It's also about the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, which she has worked so hard to bring into the world. The film is now available on PBS. There is no charge, and I will link to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 675. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear. nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Nut nuts of the week.
Earlier this month, May 7 through 10, 2024, the National Energy Communities Alliance held its annual meeting in Kennewick, Washington. It bills itself as the only meeting designed to bring together the Department of Energy, federal, state, local, and tribal governments and policymakers with developers, utilities, regulators, industry, and academia to identify opportunities, challenges, and to build the partnerships necessary to support nuclear development. A job fair for pro-nukers, sponsored by the Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy. What's missing from this picture? Oh, I don't know, maybe downwinders, Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act, contrary viewpoints, any discussion of radioactive nuclear waste? And the biggest irony is that this meeting took place less than 30 miles from the Hanford site in Washington state. That's where plutonium was manufactured for the Nagasaki bomb, and so many others, and that is considered to be the most radioactively contaminated site in the country, if not the Western Hemisphere. You can't expect oppositional opinions from those who believe that we should be building nuclear partnerships and projects, but come on, does this have to be funded by taxpayer dollars with no involvement of community oppositional leaders? No contradiction of the assumption that more nukes is good nukes? It's just another steaming pile of radioactive propaganda talking points, and that's why Energy Communities Alliance and those codependents up and down the line who support you, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nut Nuts of the Week.
This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 28, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it so easy. You can sign up for it in the absolutely unmissable yellow opt-in box by putting in your first name and an email address, and once a week, you will get an email that says, hey, this is the show, here's the link, here's a little bit about what's in it, go give a listen. And if you listen to podcasts a lot, sign up for it on your favorite podcast platform. Either way, you know you will be getting the best in nuclear news from that all-important, different perspective. Now, if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to me at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything, anything at all, nothing too small, nothing too large, we will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024. Libby Halevi, Nuclear Hot Seat, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed. As long as you give proper attribution to the program, any guests who comment you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you that nuclear kills two ways. Fast by blast, slow by glow, meaning radiation, radioactivity. Either way, nuclear kills. There you have it. You've just had your nuclear wake-up call, the one that comes to you every week. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.